doesn't bother our conversation.
Good morning. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. This morning we have, I believe, one measure for possible introduction, so I'll open a work session for that purpose. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. We do have LC 3336, dated 131 of 11, relating to crime for introduction.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I move LC 3336, dated 131-11, be introduced as a committee bill.
Thank you. Senator Cruz moves LC 3336, dated 11-31-11.
131-11.
For introduction as a committee bill. Any discussion?
Yeah, 11-31-11 would be really hard to do.
It would be, wouldn't it? All right, so that'd be really planning ahead.
Yes, it would.
All right, with that, no objection. So, and we'll close the work session on that, and then we're going to start our public hearings. But before I do so, I want to welcome Aaron Knott, who is our counsel for today. This is the first time for Aaron to be with us. He is an attorney who has practiced in the past with Multnomah County DA's office. I kind of say on leave, but I also know that you have to actually step out of your position. So hopefully you're enjoying your experience here and not knowing what happens after we get out of session.
Thank you for having me, Mr. Chair.
You bet. With that, we're going to open our first public hearing on Senate Bill 398. Aaron, if you'll give us the highlights.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate Bill 398 modifies the crimes of intimidation in the first and second degree to include offenses committed because of the offender's perception of a victim's disability. This would place disability in that type of crime alongside other categories such as race, color, religion, sexual orientation, and national origin.
All right, thank you. Bob, you're the only one I have signed up. Why don't you come up, and I'm going to ask as he's coming to get situated, is there anyone else who will want to give testimony on Senate Bill 398?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff. I'm from Disability Rights Oregon. Thank you very much for having a hearing on this bill today. This bill is the genesis of conversations that I've had with people in the disability community throughout Oregon. During the year, as you know, I worked on many legislative issues affecting people with disabilities and asked what are the important issues in that committee, in that community. And pretty much consistently, what people have voiced to me have been concerns about their sense of victimization, particularly on the streets in Portland, but in other places in the state, where they feel that they have been singled out because of their vision impairment or because of their intellectual disability or because of their severe mental illness for victimization. That led to that particular feeling of concern that's connected with a vulnerability that can be associated with disabilities and the sense that a person's disabilities may be obvious and may be perceived by others inside of vulnerability has led to the addition of people with disabilities in state statutes and federal statutes that provide extra protection for certain groups that are singled out for intimidation or other types of victimization. My testimony is incorrect in terms of in 2008, the federal Congress added disability to one of the protected classes under its hate crimes law, and as part of that, the federal government has started collecting data on the incidences of hate crimes for people with disabilities. One of the One of the limitations in that data collection has been that some states, such as Oregon, do not specifically protect people under hate crime legislation. But in the initial data that is generated in 2009, we've got a total of 96 incidences of hate crimes against people with disabilities. Interestingly enough, about three-quarters of those in three-quarters of those incidences, the victim had a mental disability, either an intellectual disability or a mental health disability. Secondly, there's absolutely no doubt in terms of crime statistics that people with disabilities are highly vulnerable to crime. And I was able to provide you, it's a little bit thick, but it's a report from the U.S. Department of Justice compiling their 2008 statistics having to do with people with disabilities. And what you find there is that people with disabilities are 50% more likely to be victims of violent crimes, and that the rate of crime against people with cognitive disabilities, and those are intellectual disabilities and other disabilities that affect a person's ability to reason, is twice as high as it is for the general population. Other statistics, and they're included in again, in the documentation. This documentation show that the rate of sexual victimization of these populations is exceptionally high. So what does that have to do with hate crime? Well, again, in terms of the what we've been able to discern, that adding a particular group to the protected groups under types of hate crimes acts as a disincentive for folks who are thinking about victimizing a person because of their obvious disability to desist, and it provides prosecutors with additional leverage for dealing with crimes that in which there is evidence that the person acted in a criminal manner because of their perception of the person's disability. And that is why we brought this before you. We were hoping to have a number of witnesses for you today to talk about their experiences. Unfortunately, given the timing of the bill and the time of day, we were unable to do that. However, if you are interested in rescheduling at a time where we're able to provide witnesses to come forward with their stories, we will work diligently to make sure that we can do that.
Okay, thank you. Questions for Senator Cruz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob, in this document from Bureau of Justice, it says disability is defined as a sensory, physical, mental, or emotional condition lasting 6 months or longer, so on and so on. Is that the only definition we have for disability, or are we tying it to some other definition somewhere else?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Cruz, the term disability is defined in other portions of state law. Generally, it's tied to definitions that are in ORS 659A, Chapter 659A, which sets forth a definition of disability. However, that definition does not reference directly.
That was my question, because there wasn't any reference to a specific definition. If there needed to be such a reference, so we know what the definition is. But
okay, fine. Looking at looks like on the words and phrases, there's multiple entries for disability, and it looks like the one that would be applicable here is a person with a disability and generally, and it's 174.107 as well as 182.109. Of course, we'll want to look at that to see if that's would be applicable for our use. But as most people who opened up words and phrases, they'd see there's about 20 different definitions for disability depending on the context it's being used. Other questions? Senator Wissett?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. I try to look at every bill through the prism of do we have the constitutional authority to enact a bill? And certainly in this instance, I mean, I think the bill is well-intended, but I would certainly question when we start talking about someone's perception of disability, how we're not in violation of the First Amendment on Section 2, 1, B, and C. And I would certainly like to hear at some time in the future a discussion on that. I need some convincing on that.
I agree. In the sense of, I think it's one of the things that being able as a prosecutor to determine someone's intent based on what their perception might be, would it be as simple as someone saying, well, the person had a disability, or would it need to be something, I did this because they had this disability? Those are the type of things I think we'd want to get a little bit more clarity and understanding.
Absolutely.
Any other comments or questions? Bob, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 398, and we're going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing, which I believe is going to be on 399. And council?
Thank you, Chair Prasansky. Members, Senate Bill 399 makes a modification of ORS 40.465. This is the portion of the statute that has to do with hearsay, just as a sort of general matter. That's the proposition that in a criminal trial, statements that are made out of court by a witness who can't be produced for trial generally don't come in against you. There are a whole bunch of exceptions. The ones we're dealing with here is something that's commonly known as forfeiture by wrongdoing, specifically statements being admitted against a party who engaged in criminal conduct that intentionally or knowingly engaged in criminal conduct that directly caused the witness to become unavailable because of death, incapacity, or incompetence. This bill would delete that exception.
Okay, thank you. All right, I have three people that are currently scheduled to give testimony. I'm going to bring up the proponent with Sean Wiley. Sean, why don't you start first, and then we'll pick up with others after that.
Thank you. Chair Prasansky, members of the committee, my name is Sean Wiley. I'm a Chief Deputy Defender at the Office of Public Defense Services, the Appellate Division, and it's my privilege to testify in favor of Senate Bill 399. Senate Bill 399 is a housekeeping bill that preserves the forfeiture by wrongdoing hearsay exception that counsel just outlined for you. It preserves that exception by removing a portion of the statute that the United States Supreme Court has explicitly found to be unconstitutional under the Sixth Amendment. By way of background, as counsel just alluded to, the forfeiture by wrongdoing doctrine holds that if a party intentionally causes a witness to be absent from a proceeding, then the hearsay statements of that witness may be admitted against the party. In 2004, the United States Supreme Court identified forfeiture by wrongdoing as an exception to a defendant's confrontation rights in Crawford v. Washington. As a result of that decision, it appears in 2005, the legislature codified Oregon's version of the hearsay exception of forfeiture by wrongdoing, and that's in ORS 40.465(3)(f) and G. And what it does is basically that the statute creates two variations of the rule of the hearsay exception. Under subsection F, it only requires that the defendant's criminal conduct cause the witness's death or incapacitation. In other words, the defendant doesn't have to intend for the witness to be absent, just that his actions caused the witness not to be present. Subsection G, which is not at issue in this bill, is what would be called maybe the core hearsay exception under forfeiture by wrongdoing. And that requires action by the defendant that had the purpose of preventing the witness from testifying. And that is traditionally been the test. In Giles v. California, which is a 2008 decision by the United States Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court specifically held that the forfeiture by wrongdoing doctrine required that specific intent. In other words, In order to say that a defendant has forfeited his right to complain that the witness is not there to cross-examine or that hearsay statements are being admitted, the defendant's conduct must have been specifically designed to prevent the witness from testifying. And in so doing, the court, in a footnote, noted that in every jurisdiction in the country, except for one, that was the rule. And it had specifically identified Oregon as the only outlier in that regard and identified this particular provision that we're proposing should be eliminated from the statute. So Senate Bill 399 simply removes the unconstitutional portion of the statute, which is subsection F, and leaves intact subsection G as the correct statement of the law under Giles. I believe that's the substance of our position, and I'll welcome any questions from.
All right, thank you. Any questions from Sean? Sean, I get, just for clarification, we are going to have Tim Sylvester and Walt Bigelow up. At your perspective, from what I don't think any of us have read, except for maybe counsel, the Giles case, but the court in there said that section, was it F of the statute was unconstitutional?
Drop the footnote said that it could find only one statute, one exception in the country that was broader than the rule it was announcing in Giles, and that was Oregon's and this provision itself.
Okay. All righty. Thank you. Any other questions based on that?
Thank you very much.
Tim and Walt, I think you two are up next. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 399? And however you want to start your presentation, feel free to go for it.
Good morning, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. I think I've submitted written testimony that I hope that you have. I'm Tim Sylvester from the Department of Justice Appellate Division. And
yeah, good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Walt Beglaw, Marion County District Attorney and President of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I'm here to support the position of the Department of Justice this morning. I haven't had a chance to fully verse myself in this issue, but have talked with Ms. Sylvester and am supporting his analysis in his position.
I want to make clear that a couple of things. First off, I think the U.S. Supreme Court's opinion in Giles versus California is not nearly as broad as the proponent just testified it is. It's important to keep in mind that this particular forfeiture by wrongdoing rule that is in the evidence code applies not only in criminal cases, it applies in civil cases, it applies in administrative cases, it applies in any case in which the evidence code applies, and it provides a very important rule that if you are a litigant in a judicial proceeding and you, by your conduct, wrongful conduct, have caused a witness who is crucial to the proceeding not to be available to testify, then you cannot complain if the other party offers hearsay evidence. It is by your wrongful conduct you have forfeited the right to object to hearsay. And what this particular provision does, 804.3f, it says if you engage in the worst kind of wrongdoing, that is, you knowingly and intentionally engage in criminal conduct that causes the witness to become dead, to die, or to become incapacitated or incompetent as a result of what you did, then you cannot complain if the other party offers statements from that witness, who statements that otherwise would be admissible. Now, what the Giles opinion said is in the context of a criminal prosecution, if testimonial statements are offered by the state that are hearsay and the defendant interposes a confrontation clause objection, then the state has to offer prove one additional fact, and that is that the defendant's wrongful conduct, criminal conduct, was intended to cause the witness to be unavailable. Now, it's important to point out a couple of things about the Giles opinion. It applies only when in a criminal prosecution and only when the defendant interposes a confrontation clause objection. So regardless of what Giles may hold, the present rule still is very important in civil cases, in administrative cases, or in any other judicial proceeding in which there is not this confrontation clause right. Now, the other thing, and so to say that Giles has invalidated this rule is a gross, gross overstatement. Rather, Giles is a very, very narrow holding that applies only in criminal cases, only to testimonial types of hearsay. Now, the other thing I want to point out is Giles, that the opinion of Giles was very careful to say that the only time this particular additional requirement is to be imposed by the Confrontation Clause is when the state offers hearsay that is what is called testimonial. And what testimonial hearsay is when a witness makes a statement to a police officer, a law enforcement agent, or something like that, accusing somebody of a crime, that is testimonial. But in all other situations, that is not testimonial and would not be covered by this ruling. And I'll give you a couple of examples to illustrate. The first example I'm giving you is kind of based on facts that were in a celebrated or important murder prosecution in Klamath County, and Clackamas County, and there was another one in Multnomah County that was similar. And that was defendant was estranged from his wife. And he called her up and he said, I want you to meet me in a particular location. So the wife went to meet the defendant, at which location he murdered her. Before the woman, the victim, left, she told somebody else, the defendant just called me and told me to meet him at this particular location. So in the criminal prosecution, it was important to be able to establish that the victim had gone to meet the defendant at a particular location and to establish that he was the one who killed her. Now, her statement, the victim's statement to a friend, to her co-worker, was not testimonial. It was not an accusatory statement to a law enforcement agent. Rather, it was a statement to her mother in the Clackamas County case. It was a statement to her co-worker in the Multnomah County case. Now, in those cases, we had to, the prosecution had to argue and figure out a way to get those statements in. The forfeiture by wrongdoing rule that currently is in place in 804.3F would allow those statements to come in, and Giles would not preclude it, because even though it's a criminal prosecution, even though it's hearsay offered against the defendant, they are not testimonial statements, and so they would come in notwithstanding Giles. And so if nothing else, it's important to keep this rule in to cover that sort of situation. Another case that I worked on years ago was a situation in which an elderly person was being cared for by a caretaker, and the caretaker was stealing the elderly person's money. And the caretaker also was not taking care of the elderly person and not giving him his medication, etc. And as a result of that, the person lapsed into incompetence and was not available to testify against the defendant at trial. Now, the victim in that situation had made a bunch of statements to family members, to bank officials, I don't want this person to have my money. But because the person became incompetent at the time of trial, those statements were not admissible over a hearsay objection. Now, again, those statements are not testimonial because they weren't made to a law enforcement agent. They were made to family members. They were made to the bank. Under OEC 804.3F, that sort of statement would be admissible if the state establishes the foundation that the defendant engaged in criminal conduct that is mistreatment of the elderly person, and that directly caused the person to be incompetent. And so this is a very important evidentiary rule that applies in administrative cases, in civil cases, and in criminal cases. And all Giles says is, in the very narrow circumstance in which it's offered against the defendant in the criminal prosecution and the statement is testimonial, only in that circumstance does the state have the obligation, in order to get the evidence in under the rule, to establish the additional fact that the defendant engaged in that criminal conduct for the purpose of silencing the witness. And so there is no reason to repeal this rule. In the narrow circumstance in which Giles applies, the courts can deal with that. Defendant can file this motion to exclude the evidence. He can rely on Giles. The state can come back with evidence to say, notwithstanding Giles, the evidence nonetheless is admissible. Or, if Giles does apply, to establish the additional foundational requirement established that is required by the Confrontation Clause, and then the evidence will be admissible. In other words, it is not It is not necessary to repeal this rule. This is a very, very important rule for all sorts of reasons.
All right, questions?
Quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sylvester, is that what's been happening? You said in narrow cases where this situation arises, the courts can deal with it by, I think you said, motion? Is that what's been happening since the Giles case was decided?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Bonamici, I am not personally aware of any case since Giles has come up in which this issue has been litigated. I would assume that that's the way it would be done in the ordinary course, and that is that the state was going to offer this kind of hearsay against the defendant in a criminal case, and the defendant was going to rely on Giles. Defendant would file a motion to exclude, pretrial motion to exclude. There would be a pretrial hearing at which the issue would be litigated, and the state would be able to establish either that the hearsay was not testimonial and therefore not subject to Giles, or that if it was testimonial, that nonetheless the state was going to prove that the defendant engaged in that criminal action for the purpose of silencing the witness. And if we could do that, then the evidence would be admissible. But I'm not aware of a case yet that has actually litigated that and made its way through the appellate courts.
Any other questions? Tim, one of the, I guess, other thing. Walt, did you have anything else that you wanted?
No, nothing, sir, Mr. Chair.
Right. So, I mean, basically what I'm hearing is that the Supreme Court has just really narrowed the application as it pertains to in a criminal matter, and if there's a confrontational clause issue that's raised by the defense, then the state is going to be required to go through this extra step as it pertains to testimonial statements that have been made. And to get it in, and so there's that will be the motion to suppress, motion to exclude, hearing that will be done, and then at that point the judge will make the decision as to whether or not that evidence comes in or doesn't.
Chair Brzezinski, that's precisely correct. Right. In the very narrow circumstance in which Giles will apply, the parties can litigate that in that individual case.
And Mr. Wiley talked about the footnote that was in the Giles decision pointing out or marking that Oregon must have maybe a statute that's a little bit broader in the sense, and that's what you're referring to as to how it applies in the civil as well as other criminal type of conduct?
Trevor Zansky, I think that Oregon is not unusual in having it applied to civil, administrative, and criminal. The only thing that is, I think, as I understand, a bit broader than normal than other states, and I think this is what the Supreme Court was talking about in their footnote in Giles, is that what OEC 8043F, the provision that's at issue here, it says that in those circumstances in which the defendant intentionally and knowingly engages in criminal action conduct that causes the victim, directly causes the witness to either die or become incompetent, then the hearsay comes in automatically without the additional showing that the party litigant had engaged in that criminal conduct with the specific purpose of silencing the witness. And so I think Mr. Wiley is correct that 8043F, the one that's at issue here, is broader than the rule in other jurisdictions, at least as far as the written evidence code is. But a lot of these, in other jurisdictions, the forfeiture by wrongdoing is a common law rule and not necessarily in the evidence code itself. But still, I mean, the fact that it's broader doesn't mean that it's bad, and particularly in the civil and administrative context, there isn't a constitutional issue with that. And as I point out in my written testimony, one of the things that the U.S. Supreme Court said in Giles was that when you're not dealing with testimonial hearsay, the states have free rein to adopt evidence rules that govern the admissibility of hearsay. And so there isn't a constitutional problem in those circumstances.
Right. Lastly, if we do nothing to this statute, we're not going to be running amok to what the Giles decision said. It just gave us a parameter under sub F of what extra step we have to take to have that be admissible.
That's entirely correct. If you leave the rule as it is and a defendant thinks that Giles requires exclusion, the defendant can file a motion to suppress, and the issue can be fully litigated in a judicial proceeding.
All right. Any other questions or comments?
Gentlemen, thank you very much. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 399. And we have one more public hearing scheduled for today, which is Senate Bill 409.
Right. Chair Brzozinski, members, Senate Bill 409 modifies ORS 8.340 insofar as it requires a judge to appoint a stenographic reporter for all proceedings involving aggravated murder trials with costs to be paid by the Office of the State Court Administrator.
All right, and we have a number of people who are here to give testimony. It looks like we have a panel, and I'm going to start with the panel, and that is Mary Fagan, Carol Studemon, I believe, and Catherine, I cannot read the last name, I apologize, Teach. Well, come on up, and you can correct me up on the record here. And did you say Teach?
Yes.
All right, thank you. Sorry for the stumbling there.
Good morning, Chair Brzozinski and members of the committee. I'm Carol Studemon, and I own a freelance court reporting firm in Portland, and I'm also the legislative committee chair for the Oregon Court Reporters Association. And I'd like to introduce to you Mary Fagan. Mary has a severe case of laryngitis and can't talk today. But she is an official reporter with Marion County, and she was the main court reporter for the Turnage case last fall and was able to provide transcripts, daily copy, rough ASCII's, all types of great services for the everyone involved in that case, and is now working on the appeal transcript for that case. We're here in support of Senate Bill 409. We know that the state needs to be efficient in how we run our courts, and several years ago, back in the early 2000s, most of the court reporters were laid off from the state. We had about 40 or 50 at the time. We now have Mary in Marion County and four in Lane County who are employees of the state, and that's all we have. And we use tape recorders in our state now for all the other court proceedings. And, you know, just like humans, they're not perfect. And except with humans, you can usually raise your hand and say, I've got a problem here, but a tape may just not work, or there may be human error that causes a tape not to work, and then when it's time to go to the appeals portion, there's no recording of the proceedings. And citizens have a right to have an accurate transcript of the case involving their day in court. We feel that, you know, the efficiencies have been put in place to save money, but we don't want the pendulum to go so far as to cause citizens to not have their right to a fair trial. And with aggravated murder cases, I'm sure you all were aware of what went on in the Turnage case. A lot of money was spent there, and it would be a real shame for everyone involved if something were to happen to the transcript to cause that to not be able to go forward with an appeal and have to go back and be retried. So we think this would be a good system to allow people to have fair access to the court system and their rights.
All right, thank you.
Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee, my name is Catherine Teach, and I am the president of the Oregon Court Reporters Association. I run and own a freelance court reporting agency in downtown Portland, and I'm here speaking on behalf of Senate Bill 409. I wanted to just say that the process of obtaining the court reporters for these aggravated trials would be that the competitive bid would be used, and it would be under similar to what the PUC now does for their contract reporting.
They would use the lowest cost and with the qualified services available.
It would require a certified shorthand reporter for the state of Oregon, and the reporter would be required to be able to do real-time and daily rough drafts and provide the services that the attorneys would need in the case. The state court administrator will pay for the travel-related costs and the time for the court reporters. The parties would be paying for the transcript costs. And I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
All right.
Thank you.
Ms. Fagan, I'm not going to ask you to speak unless you choose to.
Okay.
So unless you have something that you feel you need to say, we understand we're appreciative that you're here in support. And we have your written testimony. And so I'll open up the panel for any questions. Ladies, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
I'm sorry, Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe you said that
I'm sorry, I missed the who pays for which part, and do you have an estimate of what one of these trials would cost?
Chair Prezansky, Senator Bonamici, I have a study here from the SBA's office when they did the pilot program, mm-hmm. and that's all we have. Last year, I believe it was in 2010, there was only one aggravated murder trial done by two court reporters that shared that. And I, at this time, don't have the exact cost. I think it was around $18,000.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Again, thank you very much for coming forward. So we have, it looks like, three other people. I'm going to just I'll say two other people because I'm not sure if Jack's going to testify. Walt, if you wanted to come up, and then Gail.
Thank you, Chair Prezansky, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We heartily support Senate Bill 409. We do think it's sorely needed given the consequences from an aggravated murder case and also the certainty of appellate review that flows from an aggravated murder case. We think it's a wise investment. Firstly, the Office of the Public Defender Services has not yet been asked to do an analysis fiscally of its impact here, but we do know that much time is spent by trial counsel on aggravated murder cases recreating and correcting and trying to get an agreed record where the taped proceedings are inadequate for purposes of appellate review. And those lawyers do weigh in at $90 an hour, and some are at $60 an hour, but there is an appellate, there's an hourly rate drain in just simply recreating the record of what has occurred at the trial court level. Secondly, the consequences that potentially could arise from the lack of a good record are pretty high. We have ORS 19.130 that basically states that if there's a loss or destruction of an appellate court record that's at no fault of the appellant, that potentially the court could reverse and issue a new trial on that fact alone. There's case law that says you'd have to make a prima facie colorable showing that there was reversible error that did occur during the time of a gap in the proceedings. But the consequences are high here. In contrast, we know from speaking with aggravated murder defense counsel in other states that have stenographers there, it's so much more quick. And in murder cases, you have a lot of technical language, scientific language, sometimes just in terms of the court, the tapes just don't get it, and a court reporter right there can get the correct spelling, the correct name immediately. So we think all parties, the state, the defense, the victims, the courts, have an equal interest here, and we support the bill. Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Walt Beglaw. I'm the Marion County District Attorney and President of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and I'm here to support Senate Bill 409 in both of those capacities this morning. Quite frankly, stenographic reporting is the finest way to preserve the activities of a courtroom. And I think any litigants who have been through that process, particularly in a complex case that spans weeks and sometimes months of time, that's exactly what needs to happen. Not only for purposes of appellate review, which is quite likely in the lion's share of aggravated murder cases one way or another, those are going up, but for the efficiency of the court. When I think back of some of our judges having to look at motions that were litigated months ago or weeks ago and then bring the parties to one place on what was decided in that particular case for purposes of new decision-making or evidentiary issues, it is vital that you're able to have that stenographic response, and it is one that is immediate and extremely effective. So that's really important. You'd be able to reach back during the span of those complex cases. Second thing I'd say is it really helps advocacy. The Woodburn bombing and aggravated murder here in Marion County recently proved that the litigants could draw upon immediately information they had, testimony of witnesses, prior rulings in the case, and they were more effective not only in the defense side but on the state side and for the court to be able to have that. And so stenographic reporting in major cases is vital to good, strong advocacy for all of the three parts of a courtroom proceeding. And, of course, we've heard here it eliminates that risk of error. Court staff do a wonderful job. They've got a lot on their plate, getting the recording, that type of thing going. But in a case like this, having stenographic reporters just takes that off the table as an issue. And we haven't had any recent cases. I looked around, but we have had cases reversed, significant cases, because the machine didn't get turned on or for some critical proceedings, or we've had that issue come up before in our courtrooms. And so for all those reasons, this is just a really good idea for Oregon.
Questions?
All right, I think you're off the hook.
Thank you very much. Jack?
Chair,
we'll get a fiscal have some testimony.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. For the record, Jack Hesselman. I appear before you today on behalf of our client, Court Reporters International. We just have two observations about the bill for your consideration. And you've already noted one of them in the course of this hearing. This bill does not come to you with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, although there is a cost associated with it. We urge you to pass this bill on to Ways and Means so the courts do not meet an unfunded mandate in terms of meeting this requirement. Also, we'd observe for you and make an offer that the nature of the requirement is prescriptive in terms of the technology. It speaks only of stenographic reporting. That may be the best way to preserve a court record. However, there are other methods such as voice writing, videography. We just mentioned that for your information, that the methodology of recording is prescriptive in scope to stenographic reporting. That could factor into a cost analysis as well. So with that, I can take any questions.
All right. Any questions? All right. I think that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 409? Not seeing anyone, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 409. And Senator Wiss has asked if we get a fiscal. Yes, we will have a fiscal on this because there definitely would be cost. And I would assume that if there's any cost, from what I understand, if the bill is to move forward, it will definitely have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Well, I think the last gentleman made it very clear that this would be an unfunded mandate without money. And I think it's really, I would very highly support the bill, but it needs to have money along with it.
Yeah, but I'm not sure if it really would be an unfunded mandate because it's the state courts that were basically mandating that would be doing it as compared to going to the local level.
But the folks in the judiciary might think that.
Yeah, that's true. The other thing, I guess, is what I'd like to do is maybe get a little bit more information, and those who are proponents to the bill may want to contact Aaron, since he is our counsel on this bill, regarding alternatives to firm stenography, from what I've heard Mr. Esselman said, as to whether or not that would be something that would be something we'd want to consider in the bill, since we are in a different electronic era than maybe what we've been in the past. So that's the only comments I have. Anything else for the good or the order?
Well, Mr. Chair, if we're going to go there, the reliability of those other electronic means would also be valuable. The one thing I do know for a fact is if you got somebody there doing it, the reliability is relatively high.
Right. So I think if we're going to have that comment, we'll actually have some additional discussions about it at least in a work session with invited testimony.
Okay.
All right. With that, we're going to go ahead and close the Judiciary Committee for today, and I believe we're scheduled for tomorrow at 8:30, so we'll stay tuned until then. Thank you.